Well, I was sitting here thinking. I tried to make things as interactive as possible. And often when I do a training, it'll be an all-day thing. And I'll bring in wheelchairs and long canes and all kinds of devices and experiences so that people can actually feel something different. Some people hate these things and say, well, you can get up and walk away afterwards. But, you know, your body remembers. We've got all kinds of knowledge and memory that we don't even use. So obviously, we're not going to do that today. And then I thought, well, I could just have people raise their hands and say, you know, have you had some experience? And of course, that's a silly thing, because it's really something that cuts across all of humanity. It cuts across race. It cuts across gender, age, you name it. It's something we all share or will share, and that is frightening. It's a very scary topic. You know, lately there's been the, you know, having difficult conversations, lectures going on all over the place. This particular one is pretty scary because it's, I call it, you know, the country club that anybody can join whether they want to or not, you know, very suddenly. So we all share this, and it's the way our culture, the culture that we are in now, spins it is not very good. It's not positive at all. And you think, wow, positive disability, how could those two words go together? But I mean, what we see in media, for instance, because media shapes a lot of what we see and believe and the stereotypes that we acquire. Think about who the monsters are. This is the monster movie theory. You know, if you think about Captain Hook, he had one arm. The Wolfman actually probably had, now I've just blanked on the name of, there's actually a condition that causes basically fur to grow. I always am sort of on the line about Frankenstein because he's dead, but, you know, given all of the stuff that's happening in medicine right now, I mean, we're living our science fiction. So some of these things, who knows? So I usually, when I'm teaching students, I usually say, okay, your assignment is to go home for a week and watch TV, and who are the villains? And what are their blemishes, if you want to use that term? There was a scientist, Irving Goffman, who wrote a book called Stigma, where he basically analyzed disability, prostitution, people who were in prison, you know, basically the offside, the outsiders, and what they all had in common. But often writers in media will use disability as a shorthand for bad. So we all grew up with that. I grew up with that too. It took me the longest time to figure this out. You know? And you know, for me, it was a process of not internalizing things. You know, was I a bad guy? I don't know. Maybe I am. I don't know. And where it really starts to hit, though, is with aging, because we're all getting older. And you know, if I'm being particularly evil, you know, I'll say, hey, you'll be here too. Just wiggle your, you know, so such and such an age. But it is true. As you get older, your body changes, and a lot of these changes manifest as things which would be considered disabilities. The whole field of disability, I mean, I'm in a wheelchair, which is the symbol for disability in the world. You see a wheelchair, you know, don't park there unless you have a placard. But only about 1% of people in the United States use a wheelchair. It was the only symbol they could come up with that they could sort of capture the feeling with. But disability takes all kinds of flavors. You know, you might have diabetes. That's a disability. Heart condition is a disability. You know, there are mental disabilities of all sorts, you know, just, and they come and go, some of them in and out of popularity, because like right now in the schools, all the kids get diagnosed with ADHD or all of those things, which personally, some of them I don't find to be a disability. I find them to be an adaptation to the way our world is going, because the skills that go along with them are fabulous in some cases. So, you know, it's really where you stand or sit. You know, it all depends on that. And part of it is sort of breaking your mind open to start taking in the fact that this is not necessarily bad, even though we've been told it is. let me see, I have my disability assumptions, so I don't want to lose any of them. There's a great deal of fear, though, that goes along with it. So I spend a lot of time dispelling fear, because really, ever since I was a kid, I had polio when I was 5 months old, so I kind of grew up into it. But always had this feeling that I was one step or one, you know, yard ahead of my peers, saying, hey, it's okay, I'm a little bit ahead of you, but it's not so bad when you get here, really. You know, it can be kind of fun. And, you know, there are some times when I'm really happy to have a disability placard, I'll tell you. You know, that parking thing? There's also some other parts to it, too, you know, where it plays into society. There's something that, there's a woman, Stella Young, who's unfortunately since passed, but she was a young woman with, I think she had osteogenesis imperfecta, which means her bones broke easily. So she was in a wheelchair. She was also a comedian. But she coined the term disability porn. And if you think to, phrases like, now my mind's going to blank on this. The only disability is a bad attitude. Phrases like that really are not, they're not positive for disability. It's making some assumptions that don't work. Jerry Lewis was, you know, played to that, you know, these poor little kids, and or the little kids, you know, who are magnificent and doing things way beyond, you know, they're inspirational. So disability porn is about inspiration. And she talks about, you know, getting an award from her school basically just for remembering her name in the morning, you know, because, you know, to see her, wow, it's like, wow, you made it out of the house, you know. Although I do have mornings I feel like that too. Wow, I made it out of the house. But that is another overlay in our society that's not really that positive. But there are some really positive things that come out of disability and having some sort of condition. First of all, one of the things that over the years I've talked to, you know, I have lots and lots of friends with disabilities, and very strongly in the population of people who grew up with something. So you had something from, you know, CP or polio or those sorts of things. You wouldn't change. If someone said to you, I can magically make you, you know, straighten upright and just like everybody else, so-called, I wouldn't do it. And none of them would either, because that's what's made us who we are. And part of who we are is also colored by how we've interacted or been interacted with by society. So it, you know, there are people who go the other way, but I think most of the people I know have learned humility, they've learned compassion, they've learned patience, big time. And these things are incredibly important and something that can be shared back. I had a friend who used to quote me. There was one phrase I came up with: there's no such thing as bravery. Bravery is simply lack of options. Because when you think of it, you know, what would you do? Stop? I mean, how? You know, my mother did threaten to do that once. She threatened to never get out of bed again. She wanted to just stay there. But then nobody came to wait on her, so that didn't work. You know, so you don't have a lot of options in it. I think Helen Keller was one of the people, probably many more, said the only way out is through. So you go through it. And you go through some pretty horrendous things sometimes. And it's even harder if it's a family member or a child and you're watching them go through it, because it's hard to know how to react and it seems like an enormous tragedy. But it's not. In the long run, it's making someone into someone incredible. So some of the things you learn with a disability or a condition, and this is sort of very broadly, how to live with pain. I live with pain. I have pain all the time. We have an epidemic in the country of opiates, and part of that is because we've been told we shouldn't be in pain. Pain is something to be avoided at all costs, and I think that that's part of where that whole thing has come from. Pain teaches you something. For one thing, it tells you to stop. If you pay attention to it. But it also teaches you patience And it teaches you some kind of fortitude. You know, you will find a way through it. And so, you know, pain like disability is not necessarily a bad thing, even though we've been told that it is. You learn the ability to be compassionate because you understand the it's not the right word. It's not the condensation of pity. But you kind of get the idea. You know, pity is feeling sorry for someone. Empathy is feeling with them. And it teaches you to feel with them. You know, you know what that feels like. And you can see, you know, maybe ways of helping them get through it. Part of it is just being a witness. A lot of it is being a witness. And just being there, and they know, you know, how they feel. And that's huge. We are all lonely. So to not be lonely in the world at that moment of dire need is good. And sometimes you live with the unique life experience of how to live in the midst of suffering and the face of death. Because, you know, death is something, I used to say, you know, when you see someone, you know, you encounter someone in a wheelchair or visibly disabled, and, you know, you have never interacted with anyone before. It's not your experience. In some way, in the back of your mind, partially because of the media thing, you're looking at death. You're looking at the future, and you don't like that. And, you know, your first thought as a human being is, oh, you know, there but for the grace of God, go I. And that's okay. I also like to give people permission to think as human beings. You know, none of us want to go there, but you know, it's not so bad. You also have the experience of injustice and oppression, which teaches you what's needed for justice, injustice and oppression, which teaches you what's needed for justice and healing. There's a lot of oppression around disability. You get glimmers of it too in the news now, where you know, you hear about them cutting funds for this or cutting funds for that. And I actually, with Connie, the woman who wrote the book, I was doing a class, and we did a lot about assisted suicide, which is another term that comes up. I don't know if it's passed in Massachusetts. They were trying to push it again, you know. It's terrifying because it's a very slippery slope, and a good number of the people who worked with Kevorkian, who is now passed himself, they weren't people who had terminal illnesses. They were basically convinced that their quality of life was so poor that, you know, they really shouldn't be around. And it gets dangerous sometimes when, you know, there are families involved, and you know, someone is costing a lot of money, costing a lot of time, and there's not that connection, you know, to help, to even have the resources to continue. So that's a really scary topic, and it's one that's in the news. I mean, there are a number of states now that, you know, allow that. My friend Connie, when she would go into the hospital, she would bring a team, of which I was part, my wife Kate was part, and probably about 15 other people. She would have people around her for 24 hours at a time, just in case, or to prevent someone, you know, in the medical field to decide, well, maybe your quality of life is not good, maybe we should just turn the ventilator off, because she used a ventilator too. And it was a given for us. We just knew, oh, Connie's in the hospital, everybody mobilize, you know, we'll do that. She had a whole team of people, she used a ventilator, she had a whole team of people trained to help her, you know, clean out the vent and do that, which is some pretty serious medical stuff. And her friends all turned out to do it, because the alternative was a scary possibility. The other thing you learn, you learn creativity, because it's the only way to survive, because the world is not a friendly place. I traveled downtown I was by Trinity Church, and I made my way up to one of the Copley hotels, and I almost died about four times because of the pits in the sidewalk, and it was incredibly difficult. You know, it's not, you know, you don't see a lot of people out these days in wheelchairs, I think, just because it's so incredibly dangerous. One of my experiences with her was traveling to Canada. We were actually going to camping at a women's music conference outside, and she had about 9 people, I think, with her for that. And we were going across Canada and staying in a motel there. And when we got to the motel, there was a curb into the room about yay high, about 6 inches high. And she used a wheelchair called a permobile, which weighs about 1.5 tons and can jump your car. You know, it just incredible device. She could rise up and, you know, flatten out and do all kinds of things. But we couldn't get it into the room. So we started looking around and we saw this pile of, you know how they put like they used to do the Phoenix, you know, like newspapers. And they'd have these piles of free newspapers. So we spotted a couple of those. So we gathered them all up and we built a ramp out of the newspapers into the room. And it worked just great. So, you know, that was the sort of creativity you had to come up with, and it was constant. You know, it's a constant workaround just to get through the day, especially if you're going out into the world. You learn, obviously, a different perspective on ethical and social issues. You give it empowerment to your anger, because there's a lot of anger involved with, you know, some of the situations you encounter. And that's okay. Anger is very powerful. People are afraid of their anger. And I say to them, you know, you can reach right down there and pull up some of that rage and just use it. It'll give you energy. And everybody has it, but most people are afraid of it. You learn to deal with ambiguity and ambivalence. Because everything is ambiguous. But you also have the advantage of living on the edges. And as a kid, I was also, and as an adult, I became an artist. And that was also handy, because it gave you permission to not have to think like everybody else. I'll talk about that, because we're working into that as a culture, I think, too, which is good. And ultimately, well, there's an invitation to irreverence. You ideally probably develop a really interesting and weird sense of humor. And that gets you through a lot, too. Mine's pretty weird. But you do learn the wisdom of the broken world to live with suffering and have it be okay. So these are some of the things that come out of disability. There are good things and powerful things and things to be shared. Let me see. I have 4 parts to this. Okay. Now, the title of this sermon is Disability and Creativity. And as I say, they don't go together, but you begin to see how they can when you use your newspapers to get into a room and much larger things than that. But it's been fascinating to me, because my entire life I've been on the edges, and my family... they were, as many families are, unusual. They were artists. My father was an inventor and a carpenter, and my mother was a toy maker. And we had no money because of all the operations, so we made everything we needed, including, hey, let's throw a wing on the house. Okay, let's start. And I grew up with a hammer in my hand, so I learned how to do everything. I'm a pretty good Finnish carpenter. A few years ago, my wife and I put wooden floors down in our house together. And I can remember when my mother was in her 60s, we were outside building a 20 by 24 brick patio with a 6-foot stockade fence embedded in concrete. And I had my own cement mixer named Gladys. So, you know, it makes you very resourceful. You have to be resourceful. And that's really cool these days, because the world is changing. We are living our science fiction, but we've got devices like this, which saved me this morning because I couldn't print out my notes. It's like, oh, damn, what do I do? So I put it on this, and look, it's here, and it's living out in the web and coming in. And, you know, this is all like magic. So we're living in a magical time. I used to work in a field called assistive technology back in 1990, which is, I went around the state telling people how cool, you know, voice-activated computers were, and they cost a fortune. They were like $17,000, $20,000 to have your computer listen to you and do whatever you wanted. Now I've got an iPhone that does the same thing with apps for free. And it's, I mean, in a way, it's not a bad time to be disabled in that sense, because all sorts of adaptations exist out there, you know, for seeing, for hearing, for remembering, and they're available to everyone. So that part is great. And it's a time for creativity. It's a time to not think inside the box anymore. And bend the rules. That's the other thing I've discovered that... And I learned it with Connie, you know, rules are, well, goats are my example here, because goats can get out of anything. They are very, very smart, but they don't. And why don't they? It's habit. So we're all in the habit of thinking the way we think we should. My wife and I have been exploring this recently with our son, who's 15. Yes. We're living through that. Not something everybody in their 60s should be doing, but hey, it's okay. But we put him in an alternative school. We took him out of public school because it just wasn't working, even though we live in a town that everybody moves to for the schools. Not for him. He doesn't think that way. He thinks with his hands. He thinks by watching videos. He doesn't do it like everybody else in the, you know, the schools that would be the normal schools. Neurotypical, I think, is that? That was the phrase. But we put them in a little school where there's no grades, there's no homework, there's no assignments. He can choose what he wants to take and what he wants to do and when he wants to do it and how much he wants to do. And he's flourishing. He's just, you know, there was growth in the first day. There was growth in the first week. And this has made me sit back and look at, what do we believe automatically? Things like, you have to graduate from high school. Well, theoretically, he may not get a diploma or a GED or any of those things, but he'll probably be in college before his co-students back at the old school are even out of high school, because the kids start taking college classes, either online or live, and, you know, you can do that. And so he'll already be getting his associate's degree. So he doesn't really need a high school diploma. And this has made me think about so many other things. What do we believe? What have we been told? And it, you know, definitely, you know, plays into some of the disability things. So it's permission to be outrageous. So I'm giving you permission to be outrageous, and I hope you'll carry this thought with you that, you know, it's kind of like rules are made to be broken. Well, in a way they are, because they need to change sometimes. Let me see. Oh, and the goat thing? Well, goats stay in their pens because of habit. So, you know, habits are something to look at. Now, the thing about disability, and I've always used the Alice in Wonderland quote, you know, you have to run as fast as you can to stay in the same place, you have to run twice as fast as that to get anywhere. There are days that feel like that. It's not always easy. But the other phrase I think of is, you know, the impossible just takes twice as long. So sometimes that works too. There's another side to some of the inventions that have come along. There's a phrase called deaf gain. And what that means, and it, in terms of one device, but it maps out to others. Deaf gain is the concept that something developed for a disabled population of some sort has mapped out into the whole culture in a way that's made it easier for everyone. And that, for instance, would be like closed captioning. How many times have you been in a really noisy bar or restaurant? Doesn't have to be a bar. You know, and there's captioning on the TV that's up on the wall, and you can actually follow what's going on. or you're learning English as a second language and you can follow along and figure out what they're saying. That's deaf gain, and there are so many places that this is starting to happen. So that's a great thing that's been happening. So in terms of creativity, the other thing that's fascinating to me is, maybe you've heard of the idea that there are many jobs that don't exist yet that will be coming. And I saw one of these coming about 10 years ago and started actually preparing for it because it's something I do anyway. The job is, one of the phrases that's connected with it is something called makerspace. Has anybody heard of that? Okay. Do anybody want to take a crack at explaining what it is? Oh, come on, be brave. Okay. Well, you'll see. Okay.
I like to view makerspace as, because they robbed us all, all our children, of home ec and shop and all of those haptic things that got us into doing natural, just everyday life things and exploring in such ways. They took all of that away and it created this void, this need for people to want to do things, to make things again, and just get in there and mess around and make things. And I think that's a lot of what makerspace is, just getting in there and getting around and making things. And a lot of makerspaces, I'm the non-techie person in our relationship, but a lot of makerspaces are connected to electronics, Arduinos, all of that kind of stuff, the ones at MIT, the ones in the other, you know. But there are also makerspaces that are teaching people how to sew. Kids don't even know how to put a button on anymore, you know, or things like just getting in there and figuring things out, putting things together. How does this work? I don't know. Let's mess around. That's what I see makerspaces.
And this is a phenomenon it's been growing over the last 5 years or so. You'll see it in libraries a lot. Boston Public Library has, I don't know which branches have them, but the main library has a makerspace. I'm going to the Newton Free Public Library to build a makerspace there. Watertown has one called Hatch. So, for instance, if you needed to use or wanted to learn how to use a sewing machine, you could go to these places and learn how to do it. You could go the poster child of makerspace are 3D printers. You've all heard of 3D printers. The price on them has come way down, and the kids are going crazy over this. And they're in the course of using a 3D printer, they're learning how to do coding and work with computers and do a whole raft of other things too, which are going to be critical for their futures. And so I look at jobs like this and think, wow, you know, what other jobs could we identify now that we could steer our kids into? You know, this is something else to think about. But for me, you know, this whole piece, it's all part of being creative. And I mean, I'm being handed, you know, the best job in the world because now I can go and help people invent whatever they want and sometimes blow things up. But we don't talk about that. Well, I'll just mention, you know, one of the other things coming along, which would be something to watch in terms of this sort of thing, is genetics. I don't know if you've seen all of the stuff that's growing in the news about either identifying new disabilities or diseases or conditions, or finding out who your relatives are, or catching serial killers. I mean, it's one of those pieces that's just growing by leaps and bounds. But I guess what I'd like you to take away is just, you know, the idea of thinking outside the box. Creativity is something that's for everybody. And especially if you have something to cope with, or you have a relative or a friend, or you're trying to just understand, you know, how do people get through things, you can do it with some creativity and not being not letting the fear stop you. The fear will be there. There's always fear, and it's just, you know, plowing through it. So I also wanted to sort of open this up as sort of a conversation. I didn't say that at the beginning because I've been rambling on, but would anybody have any thoughts? that they would like to share, or questions, things that have come up as we've been talking? Yes.
I want to say that finding captioning, like Wheelock Family Theater as captioning, I know I can go on those nights and not miss out on like 60 to 70% of what other people hear. So just little things like that just are really, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes like the first time I saw that someone cared enough to have that.
Yeah, I have to say, I came in and I was impressed because I noticed you have large print orders of service. It's like, wow, you know, that used to be more common actually, but I'm impressed that you've got it. Yes. Thank you. This, yes.
I just like to remind you about aging in place too. It's not just about people coming and visiting you, which is very important. Visitability is very important, but all of us like the opportunity to age in place. And so, if you want to maintain being in this congregation, you want to be able to be up on your altar and, you know, be in places of positions of power, or get to your bathroom, or get to your, you know, your coffee hour. But also, it's the same thing of, I know with my mom decided that she was going to die by the time she was 80 because she was not going to come to save her, despite watching Mare over the course of many years. But that was not going to happen to her. Oh, goodness, no. No, no, no. She wasn't going to be a burden to anyone, Mom. But anyway, it was the idea that, don't you see that by giving yourself the assistive technology, the different things, making those things available to you, you're increasing your quality of life. You're making your life better. It is a scary thing, but I've seen so many older people be so afraid of it that they isolate themselves and keep themselves from having a good quality of senior living because they won't use the assistive technology that's available to them. I recently, talk about creativity, I recently saw a person who was blind get off of my train in Sharon, and he had his dog, and he stopped at the stairs, and I thought, oh, I should go ask him if he needs help, and I walked up to him and asked, do you need any help, sir? And he said, no, I was just orienting myself with my GPS. So he was using his phone and his GPS to figure out where he was going, and just maneuvering that way. I was like, whoa, good use of that. That was cool.
And what I've, and this is my own experience too, when I find my life starts to constrict, because that's what happens as you age or as your disability changes. And that's another part of it too that I don't see mentioned anywhere, but as your body changes, your life changes, you go through periods of grief. This is an ongoing thing. And the first time it happened to me, I thought, oh my God, what's going on? Am I going to die? You know, it just, I didn't really, I mean, it had been happening forever, but it was a particularly bad bout of it, I guess. And we do. Every time something changes in your life, even changes for the good sometimes, but it causes periods of grief, and you get through it. It's one of those things, it's getting through out by going through. And people don't realize that and think, you know, they think they need medication and everything else for it. And sometimes it's just going through it and realizing. But when your life starts to constrict, it may be a clue that maybe there's something that you can do that will make it easier. For instance, I see this a lot with some of the older friends I've had where they, you know, they're like, you use a scooter. Because I have a scooter too, which is on loan to the elderly gentleman who lives behind me because he's trying it out. You know, because sometimes things get too hard to do. You know, if the wheelchair gets to a point where I have trouble pushing it, I'll go back to a scooter. But there are many people who think that that's failing. You're failing. You know, you're not doing it. And life constricts. You don't get out. You don't meet with your friends. You know, you want every ability or every possibility to expand your life and to live fully. So that's where that is important, I think. But it's also a clue. If you find things seem to be constricting, look and see if maybe there's something you need to change. So. Yes, Ruth.
And people with disabilities are living longer than they ever have in the history of the world. And the medical field, a lot of people do not know what to do when someone who is 60 walks into their office with a muscular disability. And they only know how to think inside the box. And I would invite all of us, as our lives to invite our doctors to join us in that journey and become partners in our quest for good quality of life for as long as we can.
Mm. Anybody else? Well, thank you so much for inviting me. You've actually given me the opportunity to do some more research, because there were so many things I discovered in looking at these pieces in this particular way, and you know, I definitely need to collect some more readings, and maybe do some writing too. So, thank you.